Welcome to the Elements of Being podcast, where I dissect and explore the minds and habits of psychologists, filmmakers, writers, and industry icons. Essentially, we learn what makes them flip the switch to achieve great feats, goals, and milestones, and a chance to geek out over the psychology behind human behavior. Specifically, I examine the mental and emotional narratives and processes that have steered intriguing professionals and people from all walks of life. Each episode is also a glimpse into the trends and patterns of human behavior and the underlying influences that navigate us into different directions. Whether we primarily focus on nutrition or the unconscious, guests share insights, thought-provoking lessons, the nuances of creativity, and the elements of being us. In today's episode, I dive into the world of regenerative organic farming with Dr. Ron Weiss. He is dual board certified in internal medicine and lifestyle medicine. As a primary care physician in New Jersey, Dr. Weiss serves as the executive director of Ethos Primary Care and as assistant professor of clinical medicine at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. He's not only a physician, he is also a botanist and farmer, and he offers an evidence-based food as medicine approach to healing chronic illness and optimizing wellness. Dr. Weiss has been featured in top media, including the New York Times, the New York Post, the Today Show, New Jersey Monthly, and the feature-length documentary Eating You Alive. A vegan-friendly plant-based doctor in New Jersey, Dr. Weiss prescribes the Ethos Diet, an all-organic, ecologically sustainable, and whole food plant-based diet as a cornerstone of his work with patients. He's not your typical doctor. His primary care practice resides on 342 acres of farm in Long Valley, New Jersey, where he grows beyond organic produce for his patients. Otherwise known as the farm doctor, Dr. Weiss believes that food is medicine and in a farm-based healthcare system. He additionally holds a dual baccalaureate degree in botany and music from Rutgers University, which we explore in great depths. Here's what we discussed: how Dr. Weiss's passions have intersected, Dr. Weiss's lifelong connection to botany and agriculture, the evolution of his medical practice to a regenerative organic farm, the effects of chemicals and current farming practices on the soil and the environment, the distinction between beyond organic and typical organic certifications, the foundation of regenerative organic farming in the Farm Ethos Project, the debate over the best regenerative practices, the recommendations for those farmers with the same connection to the history and cultivation of the land, but who haven't pivoted to a sustainable, environmental, mindful practice, how we can connect our kids to agriculture in urban settings with a new, sustainable, organic perspective and the guidance they need to become stewards of the environment. So with all of this being said, let's jump in. Hello, Dr. Weiss. Thank you for sharing the table with me today.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Outside of the unconscious influences on our behavior, we can't ignore the underlying influences on our physical health. Your sustainable organic farm and medical practice promote a return to the very foundation of the most important elements of optimal health and longevity: food as medicine. The name of your efforts is Ethos Primary Care, Ethos being a powerful Greek word meaning character that is used to describe the guiding beliefs or ideals that characterize a community, nation, or ideology. What was the initial belief, the foundation of which your practice is built on, and how has that evolved over time?
Well, the word ethos, as you mentioned, has Greek roots, and its meaning is links to the guiding philosophy of an organization, as you mentioned. And we struggled for a long time to find a name for this farm and this farm project. And we finally took the name Ethos because it connected to what we are doing here in many ways. In one way, the community in which this farm is located was the first community in the nation, actually to the first town to utilize its tax base to preserve a farm. The townspeople took about $12 million, and this was in the early 90s, which was, you know, worth considerably more than it is now, and use this money not to buy the farm, but just to get an easement to prevent it from being developed. And then the county and the state of New Jersey came in after the fact, a year later, and reimbursed the town without the town ever being assured that they would ever get their money back. And it was the first time in the nation that an action like this ever took place. So our first thought was that it was the ethos of the people of this community of Long Valley, New Jersey, that allowed us to actually have this farm here and for it not to be just a bunch of housing developments and strip malls. And then, of course, you know, the term ethos has other connections for us. It comes from the original root where ethical comes from. And in our practice of medicine and our practice of healing, we always try to adhere to the ethics that benefit, you know, us and all living things.
Yeah, and the Greeks also use this word ethos to refer to the power of music to influence emotions, behaviors, and even morals. Outside of current professional practices, you have a lifelong passion playing the piano. Where have all these interests intersected at different points of your life?
They continue to intersect. They've been present during the length of my life. As far as music is concerned, you know, it was my first language. I could read music before I could read the written word or English. And, you know, I do believe music is such a powerful force that it can move us to do sometimes the unexpected or possibly the impossible. And it does definitely affect our emotions. And music is always a part of this farm. You know, even if I am not playing the piano or the violin or my children are playing, the music can be heard in the hundreds of different bird species which are ever present here. Our farm is noted for, and our valley is noted for, the highest species count of birds in New Jersey after the Cape May Flyway, which happens to be the number one site for spotting birds. Species or one of the number one spots in North America. So the songs of birds and insects and water and the wind are always here on this farm. So I think that this ethos of music, I think, runs through the soil and our vegetables and affects the people here and hopefully imbues them with passion and the desire to heal.
And this is a perfect time to talk more specifically about your farm. You grow organic produce, educate the community on plant-based eating, and practice primary care medicine on this spectacular 280-year-old working farm in Long Valley, New Jersey. Unless you're personally connected to the farming industry, many people never really imagine themselves as farmers. What connected you to botany and agriculture at such a young age?
You know, I see as the seminal event seeds, literally a packet of seeds, which my mother gave me as a gift for my fourth birthday. And there were 4 o'clocks, which is an old-fashioned flower, which I think may come from Peru because the original name was Marvel of Peru in the 19th century. But these flowers, these little trumpet-shaped flowers, open at 4 o'clock every day, and they are beautiful, beautiful pastel colors and pinks and whites and yellows and reds. And these flowers are so unusual because not only are they solid colors, but they come in splashes and paisleys and stripes, and you can have two different colors of flowers on the same plant. And as I planted these when I was young and watched them, it was just so amazing for me to see these amazing features, these amazing, beautiful flowers of different colors come from one plant. And all of this growth just come from a tiny black seed. And I think it got me hooked. That process of putting this seemingly inert speck in the ground and seeing this wondrous thing sprout from it and grow into this living organism turned me into a lover of plants and growing things.
And you didn't begin your farm until you were well into your career. Was there always a pervasive mental push to open a farm?
Yes, because of this love of growing things, I always wanted to be a farmer. But, I was encouraged to go into medicine, not even music, even though before I was 18, most of my life was taken up with music. My parents guided me not to go into music, of course, because they wanted to make sure I could make a living. So they guided me to go into medicine. And then, that took over my adult years until, I was middle age when I began to realize that all the patients I were seeing and all the raft of chronic diseases I was seeing in my patients was due to the food that they were eating and the corrupted food system that was supplying this food. And then I decided at that point, I'm going to have to go back and perhaps develop a different model where the care came directly from a farm and a food system that was providing good food to people so they wouldn't be sick. And that's when I switched. I sold off my old practice, which was in an urban area, and I took all the proceeds and I bought this broken down old farm.
And describe the moment, whether it was in your car, talking to your wife, visiting another farm, maybe even talking to a patient, when you decided, this is it. It's time for my medical practice to evolve from the office to the field.
It wasn't a crystalline moment in time. I think it occurred over perhaps weeks or perhaps a month. I remember there were two consolidated moments I remember that made me think in the moment that I need to develop a practice that's embedded on a medical farm that offers healing to humans as they relate to the landscape and addresses their place within the world. In other words, the environment. And that was as I was finishing the last pages of the China Study by T. Colin Campbell. I closed the book, and it was at that point where I decided I was going to get rid of my conventional medical practice and do this. And then, we spent about 5 years trying to find the proper farm, just the right place with just the right soil, the best soils, and just the right setting, just the right area. And we came across this farm. And, this farm, this Ethos farm that we have, I have special ties to it because as a medical student, I was here, 25 years earlier before we got the farm. I was on a photographic expedition of New Jersey for my medical school, taking portraits of every county of the state where our medical students come from. And I photographed this farm as part of the dying rural areas of New Jersey. And sure enough, 25 years later, it happened to be for sale. And we came here, and so that was very moving for me. But it was the clinching moment for this farm came when I saw in a pool of water in a swimming hole in the stream of the headwaters of the Raritan River, these pure waters on this farm, I saw a blue heron, a large blue heron feeding in the water. And as soon as I saw that, in that moment, I recalled Wendell Berry's The Peace of Wild Things. I don't know if you're familiar with that poem.
I'm not.
Well, I will recite it to you with your permission.
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
But when I saw that heron, I thought of his poem. I thought of my young children who then were, about 4 or 5 years old. And seeing that heron in that wading in that pool, it was in that moment that I decided to get this form. So the poem is called The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting for their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
It's amazing your story, just having such a connection to the land and your initial experience, then 25 years later, to have the opportunity to build a new practice, which I'm sure came with some fears. Did you ever think that this step would isolate you from the medical community?
Well, I was already isolated from the medical community because of what I was doing. You know, I was already practicing what I consider lifestyle medicine, plant-based medicine, whatever you may call it, basically trying to influence people's habits instead of prescribing drugs, to especially through food, in order to reverse or prevent their diseases. And, you know, my colleagues, who I'm very friendly with and have, you know, an excellent rapport with, some of them are my close friends, you know, because I'm a primary doctor, I'm an internist, it's sort of like a one-way street. I would always be sending them patients because, you know, if I needed a colonoscopy or someone needed a pulmonary function test, I'd send them to the lung doctor. If someone was having a stroke, I'd send them to the neurologist. If someone was having a heart attack, we'd call the cardiologist. If someone broke their wrist, we'd call the orthopedist, and so on and so forth. But it ever rarely goes the other way. It's not a two-way street where that the GI doctor, if he had someone with Crohn's disease, which of course, you know, there's no good solution for in the conventional world, I would never get this patient referred to me. And I've discussed this with them in the past. And even though they're my friends, the basic philosophy or thinking on their part was, well, you know, when I would ask them, well, don't you believe that what I do is efficient or effective, or doesn't it work? And they kind of said, they admitted, yeah, sure, eating vegetables and fruits help people, but who's going to do that? So they just, and I think that's basically the thought process or feelings of most conventional doctors. They just don't think that people can do it or want to do it, want to eat diets of whole plant food. And so they're not interested. So from that standpoint, I'm rather disconnected from, I have really nothing to do professionally with my conventional brothers and sisters. You know, I have very cordial relationships with them, but they're not interested in what I do. And that's the way it stands.
Well, I know if you're certainly within an hour of Chicago, I wouldn't hesitate to use you as a doctor, and appreciate your step out of bounds in New Jersey. To return to the more specifics about the farm, it has a long history, but the soil wasn't originally cultivated for sustainable organic farming. What challenges did you face during the various stages of restoration?
Oh, boy. We face challenges every day. And this farm I see as representing the story of agriculture in America, because it's a very old farm. It's about 300 years old. It's been a working farm every day of its life since then. From its very beginnings, it was the valley it is in consisted of a prairie. It was, and you, as you might know, prairies, there may be prairies in the Chicago area, but there are none in New Jersey, generally speaking. The Northeast is originally a wooded habitat, woodland, but this was different. This valley was a rare eastern prairie, and it's because the Lenni Lenape, who are the native peoples who were here for thousands of years, maintained this valley by setting fires for hunting. And so the the valley was maintained as a grassland with the same prairie grasses that are found in the and the plain states. And so the soils, because grasslands produce probably the richest soils on Earth, the soils here over thousands of years became very deep and very rich, and they were fed by the Raritan River, which is the river that courses through this valley, or alluvial soils. And so by the time the first European settlers came and they were trudging over the mountain ridges and looked down into this valley, they saw these plains, these grasslands, and they said, quote, "This is the promised land that God that intended for us." And they decamped off the mountain and took this land and they plowed it up. So since then, they were growing basically grains in this valley. This valley has some of the richest soils in North America. And the grains were of great yields. And what happened was, as the Western expansion took hold and the Louisiana Purchase was made and the great areas of the plains opened up to agriculture, and the train came in and train lines developed, especially after the Civil War. The Northeast, a lot of it became a dairy farming land. And so this land also gave up its grain production more or less and became dairy land. And then, of course, chemical agriculture started to enter into the picture in the 20th century. As the dairy industry started to decline in the late 20th century, so did this farm. It was once the largest and busiest dairy farm in the state. The herd was sold off in 1985, and then all of its fertile soils were basically turned into GMO corn and soy production, of course, which went to CAFOs. And that's the way we found it, with heavy chemical use, genetically modified organisms. After almost 300 years, we came to this land and decided to find a way out. And so we, little by little, over the last 8 years, have been chewing little pieces of this land off, acre by acre, you know, sometimes 10, 20 acres at a time. It's a 342-acre farm. Half of it is woods, where the headwaters of the Raritan River, one of New Jersey's great rivers, spring from. And the other half is prime cultivated soil. So we took the last of the fields just this past spring, and as the lease was ended from a local conventional farmer, and converted it back into a restored prairie, grassland environment, with the same native grasses that were grown here 300 years
ago. Wow.
And so in doing that, this has become a project for us, a scientific endeavor, and we have collaborated with the Rodale Institute. Rodale, which is not far from us, about 45 minutes to the west in Pennsylvania, is the founder of the term organic and regenerative. They're the foremost authority on organic agriculture. And we are studying the capacity of these grasslands to sequester carbon into the soil, and then the ecosystem services or benefit that occur when corn soybean fields are turned over into these natural habitats.
I believe your ultimate goal is a status of beyond organic. And I was hoping maybe you could help us understand what the difference is between that and the typical organic certification.
Well, you know, Rodale was the originator of this term. And the term organic has been co-opted over the years, first by the federal government when they came out with the term, the certification for that word organic. And you have to realize that term actually cannot, it's against regulations to use that term organic if you are not certified by the federal government. Like, for example, if I grew some vegetables and I were not certified, had that federal certification for organic, the one you see with the circle that says USDA, and if I put a sign on my vegetables saying they were organic, that would be illegal. So the bottom line is that term today is controlled by the certifying agencies that serve the federal standards. However, unfortunately, although it is those standards for organic certification are much better than and do offer some assurances that the worst pesticides are not being used on your food and the growing of food. Unfortunately, the certification of the organic certification does not mean that you're growing, that the producer is growing this food in the best manner for human nutrition or in the best manner to restore the environment the food is being grown in or to help the habitat. It in no way assures those things. So because of that, and there are other things organic certification does not assure. Doesn't assure that the people who grew it, grew the food or were involved with the production of the food were treated well or fairly. So there's a new certification which is being worked on, which is called regenerative organic. And again, that invention is being driven by the Rodale Institute. And it takes into account essentially that in a food system, when food is being produced, that the system is restored and regenerates itself, which is not usually or necessarily the case in an organic food system. For example, I could take some sand, dump some organically improved fertilizers on it, and use some organically approved pesticides on the plants there. Let's say I was growing tomatoes, and it would be certified organic by the federal government. I could be doing it in a desert where I'm sopping up valuable and priceless water resources and not paying attention to the environment. I could abuse the field hands who picked those tomatoes. They'd still be considered certified organic. You can't do those things in a regenerative food production system. It's a mindful process where everything that touches that food must be taken care of, including, of course, the soil where it comes from. And once we do that, then it's healthy food to eat for people, and it's healthy for the environment that helped to produce it.
Yeah, I imagine this is the foundation of the Farm Ethos Project. Maybe you could tell us a little more about the structure of the project and what the vision is.
The Ethos Farm Project is this, I don't want to say ramshackle, because it's very intentional, but it's sort of, because we are a grassroots kind of organization, we're scrappy, I like to say that. We get by on a lot of elbow grease, hard work, very little resources. And we are in our beginning stages, still even after 8 years, but what those stages consist of are these moving pieces that all fit together on this farm. And they are all under the umbrella of the Ethos Farm Project. They are the Young Farmers Incubator Program. And what that consists of is a teaching program, more than just a teaching program. It is a program where we take young farmers onto the land, or people who want to be young farmers. They generally have really very little experience or knowledge. And we teach them to be organic, regenerative farmers. And then we give them land, because land here in the New Jersey metropolitan area is good farmland is extremely costly and hard to come by. So we give them land, we give them mentorship, we give them housing, you know, we give them food, and we teach them for 2 years to be regenerative farmers. And then when they are done with their training, they are welcome to stay here. And we give them land to grow on. And our dream is to have, our vision is to create a cooperative of regenerative farmers growing, a full diet of whole plant foods, 365 days a year, locally produced right here in New Jersey, to restore the great food-grown culture that once existed in New Jersey, even when I was a child, that was here, that kind of is fading away. So that's one element. The second element is the research project I discussed before, which is a collaborative effort between Rodale Institute, Ethos Farm, and Rutgers University. It is called the Ethos Farm ecosystem and carbon trial effect, EFECT, effect. And basically, it is how I described it, is the restoration of these native prairie grasses to build a natural habitat again. And we're very excited that there is a lot of information that shows that, these activities could be offer a substantial solution for climate change and being able to sequester carbon in agricultural soils. A third element is the Ethos Farm Days festivals, where we invite people onto the farm and have world-class speakers. Dr. Furman, of course, I know who you are familiar with, kicked off our Maiden Farm Days event last year, and they were extremely popular, sold out, and we have all kinds of activities and farm tours and speakers, and they learn about how to live healthily and have a good lifestyle and where good food comes from. And the last piece is, just as we educate young people to be farmers and raise a new generation of farmers, we raise a new generation of physicians. Now, I am assistant professor of clinical medicine at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School, and we have an approved rotation here with the medical school for senior medical students, where they come out for a month and we teach them lifestyle medicine. They see patients. They learn how to clinically take care of a wide range, a diverse number of different kinds of patients with many different problems. And it's great practical experience. And then, of course, they spend some time on the farm and find out how food is connected to health. We're very proud to say that our Ethos Farm project was chosen by the Rockefeller Foundation for their 2050 Food System Vision Prize. It's a competition that's being sponsored by Rockefeller. They invited applicants from the world over. We're one of originally 1,300 applicants from around the world to create a vision of a healthy food system for 2050. That's 30 years from now. So we entered our Ethos Farm Project, and it was chosen as a semifinalist. We hope to be chosen as finalists. We will know in about 2 weeks from now when they make the announcement. And if we have become finalists, we might have the opportunity to be chosen as top visionaries. If that occurs, one of the 10 finalists, when they were chosen, will go before the United Nations and the World Health Organization for the next year at the UN 2021 Food Summit, to present their food system for possible adoption by the UN.
Wow. I mean, absolutely incredible work, hitting so many different facets. And good luck to you and your team on the possibility of truly having a great influence across the world. All of us wonder, especially in urban settings, how we could contribute. And you certainly have taken that step with your farm and trying to reach out beyond just New Jersey. You mentioned the education facets of the program, and we know that education at an early age seems to be the most pivotal step for this type of change. How do you think we could connect our kids to agriculture in urban settings with a new sustainable organic perspective? What types of programs are necessary in our education system to guide our kids in becoming stewards of the environment?
That's a nice question. You know, I think back to my beginnings and planting those little seeds. And I think that's what we can do. We can give a child a pack of seeds and we can teach them to plant them and teach them about the wonder. And it really is just amazing. If you think about it, I like going back to, you know, when I was a little kid and imagining with the wonder in the eyes of a child, what kind of impression that would make, where you take a little speck, a little black or brown seed, and see it transformed into this life form, this vibrant life form. It is like magic. And I think that children have a special connection to nature. I know they do. You know, all human beings need nature. We need it to keep us healthy, even emotionally and psychologically. But children have special relationships to nature. And I think even if it's in an urban setting, having a community garden, even sprouting that little seed on the windowsill and in a little cup, taking a I did this with my children, just taking a sweet potato from the store and putting some toothpicks in it, letting it sprout, and then taking those sprouts off and making sweet potato slips, and even putting it in a pot on your patio on your this 32nd floor of your apartment building, and letting the child do that. It connects the child to agriculture, and letting the child pull those plants up and eat the sweet potatoes, I think it can connect the child and make them understand where their food comes from and how important it is. Always have children, wherever they are, put their hands in the dirt without gloves on. Let them get those good organisms on them from good soil, and don't wash their hands. Let them pull radishes and carrots from the ground, and without washing them, just let them eat them. Of course, you have to make sure that the soil is not filled with lead. But, you know, that there are ways to do that with soil testing and blah, blah, blah. But I think even urban children can do that. And I just wanted to mention, you know, give a shout out to the New Jersey Medical School Green Club. When we submitted our application to the Rockefeller Foundation, it was beyond more than what we just have now. The Ethos Farm Project, what I explained to you, are pieces that exist in the current day as we speak. But it required us to create a vision, to take that further and visualize what could happen in the future. And there are wonderful organizations at the medical school where I'm a professor. One of them is the Green Club, where the medical students go into the underserved Newark community, and there are social justice programs which exist there, where they do take kids who live in tenements or in public housing projects where there's not much land. And they do create gardens with them, and they do teach them how to plant these seeds and to grow using techniques that don't have pesticides and to grow healthy food. And so part of our vision is to collaborate with all these organizations and to grow these children up. And when they, in the garden, have them visit the farm here, which is about 50 minutes away, 50. And then when they graduate high school, to funnel them into the Young Farmers Incubator program, so that a poor child who was born, you know, on the streets of Newark and grew up there doesn't have to be deprived of nature and can grow up to be a farmer in New Jersey. It all starts with planting of that seed and a little garden. Our vision is to take the children who are acclimated and who have a passion for growing things and to turn them into farmers through our Young Farmer Incubator program. So that's the long answer. I always have long answers for you.
And I appreciate your long answers. And I'm just thinking about your recommendations for connecting kids to farming and the environment in general. But what do you think, what public policy should we support locally to contribute to this movement?
There are USDA programs that allow for school gardens and support that. There are programs that exist. You know, I think that is helpful. Don't get me started with the USDA. You know, for that small program that does support school gardens and teaching, the 99% of all the other policies that they implement and they carry out are so destructive to children's health, they cannot never make up for that little garden program. But that's another topic. However, it begins with a grassroots effort. I think it's very difficult. And our vision is, we tried to make it not dependent on policy. There were two areas where we had to stake our claim with policy changes. But really, I think the teaching children and surrounding them with gardens and nature, even in urban settings, has to be a grassroots effort. It begins with the parents and the teachers and involves community members. You know, it's not expensive. It doesn't have to be. You don't necessarily need a lot of funding. I think that's why it lends itself well to grassroots efforts. Even seed libraries, seed saving, where communities can get together and share seeds and save them so that they become cultivars and varieties of food and plants can be developed and evolved to be resilient to a particular place where they're being grown. That is something that's sprouting up all over the country and is available and just fun for children to get involved in.
I wanted to return our discussion back to farming practices just for a short bit. Project Drawdown and other eco-focused organizations have identified traditional farming practices as a contributor to the degradation of the environment and consequently a factor in our current climate change, as you suggested. What specific practices do you recommend for those farmers with the same connection to the history and cultivation of the land, but who haven't pivoted to sustainable, environmentally mindful practices?
Well, I recommend regenerative methods. I think that we, for about 100 years, we have assaulted our earth with, or a little bit more than that perhaps, but in a major way, for about 100 years, we've assaulted our planet with agricultural chemicals. And how much can it take? We now know the answer. It's like, how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Roll Pop? Well, nobody knew until the past 10 years when it became apparent that insects are facing mass extinction. Climate change is occurring. It took about 100 years. We're done. It's time to abandon agricultural chemicals. It's time to abandon biocides. That term was first used by and coined by Rachel Carson the year I was born in 1962 in her book Silent Spring. She saw it coming. And if you read that first chapter of her book, where everything has become silent, it's coming true. And again, I'm 58 years old. The book was printed 58 years ago. We had about 50 years of the chemicals. Another 50 or so has passed, about 100 years. I encourage all farmers to stop growing food with poisons. It doesn't make sense to poison the living soil, to poison the water and air, to stop killing. A farmer is a steward of the environment and nature and land. So that's what I would encourage all farmers to do. And no matter what you farm or how you grow it, there is a way to do it. Your heart and mind has to be open to it. That's all.
It certainly would be a big pivot for a lot of farmers where they've had a family farm in their history for many years. Like a friend of mine whose farm is been in the family for nearly 150 years in particular. I often wonder if the reason why we don't see this change is like most things in life. We've wired a system, we've built a system to support what we've been doing for a long time. And in order to pivot to perhaps a practice like this, in many ways, not only might it sacrifice one's identity, but also income. And what is the loss, you know, in order to rebuild with a new shape? So I wonder at times, even those farmers that are interested in taking this step, they're just so ingrained in this process that it's very difficult for them to do that.
Yeah, it's very true what you're saying. Farming is part of a food system, and this is why Rockefeller is having the competition. The pandemic has acutely reveal what vast problems we have with our food system. You know, the beginning of the pandemic, when you walk into a supermarket and you realize all of a sudden there are no staples anymore like grains or beans because there's been a run on them. And then you realize, holy crap, there are 9 million people here in New Jersey and we can't feed them. There are 9 million, the most densely populated state in the United States. Where are we getting our food from? I don't coming from a desert that's catching on fire in California, coming from Mexico, coming from Florida, which is struck by hurricanes, or we have a severe food insecurity. So that's a problem. And yet, you know, there are all kinds of problems where our food system, and I think that's what you're referring to, has been completely altered and deconstructed. It has to be reconstructed. And that's what the Rockefeller 2050 vision tasks us to do. It's not enough that if you have a farm that you can all of a sudden just stop spraying chemicals and have plant some magical seeds, not use chemicals, and have moonbeams. It doesn't work like that. Who's going to buy your stuff? How are you going to get it to market? Where are you going to find your customer? In New Jersey, you're eating stuff that came from Mexico. They go into enormous Walmarts and Costcos and Whole Foods, and they get it on Amazon. I mean, there's no, everything has been torn asunder, the system, the food chain, the supply chain is gone. It's very challenging. And then possibly the most difficult factor to consider is that conventional agriculture has used chemicals as labor-saving devices, right? So the reason why all these chemicals are sprayed is because they do the weeding for us. They kill the insects for us. Regenerative agriculture, by comparison, is extremely labor-intensive. And we need to find ways with technology, by introducing artificial intelligence, to come up with solutions for that intensivity of labor. Because that, eventually, that is the key to making small footprint, regenerative, organic agriculture economically viable. That's the secret. We have not figured out the economics of it yet. We struggle here at Ethos Farm Project every day to just try to meet our overhead. It's a constant struggle. It's constant. So we're trying to work through this model. And, you know, those are the suggestions and the visions we've come up, which we're proposing to Rockefeller.
I know there's some debate over the best regenerative practices, too. Do you believe animals play a role in the regeneration of the soil?
Let's take these grasslands that we restored. Grasslands are kept, which are the most fertile, produce the most fertile soils in the world. Grasslands are kept grasslands by grazing animals. Grasslands evolved with grazing animals over millions of years. They evolved together. The soil that's there and the living life in the soil is there in cooperation and coordination with the animals that are grazing on them. The grasses grow the way they do because, and the plants in the field and the flowers and the insects and everything that's surrounding them in this orchestrated symphony, magnificent ninth symphony, Beethoven, is because there are animals there. And they may not need to be cows. You know, they could be bison. They could be birds. They could be wildlife. But you always have to remember that mankind is best at agriculture, and we know this after thousands and thousands of years of growing food. When humans try to imitate Mother Nature's template and system, and you need animals to do that, you can't remove them because they're part of the symphony. It would be like trying to play the ninth symphony without a cello section. Sound like, I wouldn't want to hear it. Or take out the oboes. There are critical pieces that we got. Yes, you could play it. Yes, we could do it. We could grow food, but what would that food be like? And what impact would it have on our environment? So, you know, these things are still being worked out. When I say animals, the full meaning and implications of including animals in a farming system, I am not spelling out. It could be anything from using human waste, right? We're animals, and reincorporating that human waste back into the field. I was reminded when I first got here, our medical practice, which was an old farmhouse, has an old septic system. It's so old, it's not even on the records of the health department, and it's still working fine. It's an old wooden farmhouse, and this is where my medical practice is. I'm speaking to you from today. And I interviewed the 95-year-old farmer who, she was the last farmer to have that herd of cattle here that was sold off in 1985. She was here for 40 years. And she would tell me that before New Jersey Health Department passed a law in the 80s outlawing the distribution of the sewage onto the field, that through this valley, always farmers would take their septic tanks and deposit the human waste on the fields. And she's told me, oh, you knew when that was happening, when you were driving, because you could smell that was going on. And it's an example of how animals, we are animals, have been so disconnected. Farming is a mining operation, right? We plant things in the soil and then remove the plants with their fruits and vegetables and their roots. We're removing the minerals and the elements that came from the soil. We must put them back somehow. And if we eat those beautiful things and then we poop them out as waste, we must return it to the soil in order to regenerate the soil. So that's an example of regenerative practice, right? And it gets more involved than that. But, you know, I started off my career as an emergency room doctor. I was an emergency room attending for about 6 or 7 years in a very busy emergency room. I think back to those days. My job as an ER doctor was to triage the emergencies. If I had someone coming in with a heart attack, and then at the same time, I had someone who came in who stopped breathing, it was the person who wasn't breathing who was the priority, not the heart attack. I had to attend to that person first. And in that way, I believe I started off my career as taking care of people and their diseases and illnesses, and that was my priority. But I really think now that the diseases and the suffering of the planet is the definite priority. It is the triage emergency. Human health is no longer the priority in this triage system, because if we do not take care of the health of the environment first and foremost, we will not be here within this century. We will be gone. So human health and priority takes a back seat. And because of that, although I do not think it's healthy, I know it's not healthy to eat plant-based Beyond burgers and Impossible burgers and processed plant foods that have replaced meat, that are filled with coconut oil and all kinds of processed crap. I think that it is desirable, more desirable than continuing to eat meat that comes from CAFOs, because I think that it will ease the destructive pressures on our environment and allow humankind to survive this century. Yes, we will have even more heart attacks, cancer, and dementia, and diabetes from eating these processed plant foods. However, the rights of nature will be given a break. And I think that's why I can align myself with people becoming vegan if they can't eat whole, healthy plant foods and eating these destructive, these foods to human health. It's okay, because it does help to save our environment somewhat.
Well, in respect of your time, I just want to ask a couple more questions. And we certainly will need to plan a round two, because we've barely touched on your specific medical practice and what you do at Lifestyle Medicine, nor have we discussed the specific diets that you recommend. And we have plenty to continue on about. But I want to ask you, I have a 3-year-old son, Preston. What is one lesson that you would like to share with him?
I think that, you know, my children are not very old. They're 12 and 14 years old. So I'm not that far removed as a parent from Preston. Only, you know, 10 years, a decade. And the overall overriding factor that made me give up everything, made me give up that busy medical practice and just sell it off and just start all over again with this farm, is because of all the things that I was frustrated with. And yes, it was very difficult to take care of patients. Yes, and all the diabetes from all the crap they were eating and the food system, and it was the pollution. And when I looked at my toddlers at the time, I thought I was pressed to do this because I didn't think that they would survive. By the time they got to my age, by the time they became middle-aged in their 40s, which would be, you know, mid-century, 2050, right? The Rockefeller 2050 food system. I didn't think they'd be able to feed themselves or survive in a comfortable way. So I think it is really what we can do to help them is to do everything we've talked about in the past hour, and not to scare them, because it is quite scary, but to reveal the wonders of nature and to give them the gift to know that nature has rights that man has not recognized. Nature has rights just as human beings have rights. And if we are to survive, we need to make sure that those rights, that our rights, are subsidiary to nature's rights, because we're too powerful. We've grown too powerful with all of our chemicals and all of our machines and our vast populations, and we are so abusive of nature's rights and just take everything, consume it and use it and throw it away, that we're destroying nature. And I think that is the key, to take this 3-year-old and reveal nature to them, make them love it, give them those seeds to plant, let them nurture, grow them, teach them where good food comes from, feed them well, feed them only plants, feed them whole plants, not with chemicals, not with a side serving of poison on them, only food that was grown well. And always take them to farms that use these processes and take them into the woods, take them to the beach and the oceans and let them see nature, let them fall in love with nature and let them always protect nature and its rights. That's what I would give to Preston.
What incredible advice. We hear the passion in your voice, and you no doubt are a steward of our environment, and thank you for that. Where can people learn more about you? Is there anything you'd like them to check out in particular?
You can go to our website, ethoshealth.org, and you can learn about everything we're doing here that we've just been discussing. We have we didn't discuss this, but what we have available to the public here is our farm stand, which is, you know, we have organic, regeneratively grown produce, a wide selection of fruits and vegetables. That farm stand is open to the public. Anyone can come here. It's open this season on the weekends, Saturdays and Sundays from 9 to 3. Everyone is welcome to always come here. We think we have the best tasting produce because it comes from that living soil. So we have that. We have the other offerings we have is I have my own practice here, Ethos Primary Care, where we do practice lifestyle medicine. And we pride ourselves in taking people who are sick and reversing their illnesses, not sustaining them with medication, taking their illnesses away and preventing them. So people are always welcome to make appointments to see me. I'm a working doctor. I work every day seeing patients. Let's see what else we have. We have all kinds of other lifestyle programs. We have something called Dr. Weiss's 2-week challenge, which is you can do remotely, even on the computer. It's to jumpstart yourself into a good lifestyle of whole plant foods. And you can find that on our website. We have a wonderful Instagram page at Dr. Ron Weiss. Please follow us and you'll see wonderful, beautiful pictures of the farms and farm here. You'll see all the wildlife and things we come across as we walk the farm and the different wonders of nature. That's good to show kids. And a active Facebook page too. Ethos Primary Care is our Facebook page. You can follow our progress on our social media with the Rockefeller Foundation and keep your fingers crossed for us. We hope we make it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I'll be sure to include links to your farm, practice, and projects, everything that you just described in our show notes. We are left here with quite a bit to think about, and it has been an honor and pleasure to discuss your farming and medical practices. I wish you and your patients the best of health, especially at such a time with the pandemic. So cheers to your incredible contribution to our world.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
If you find this podcast interesting, there are many ways you can support it. You can review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen on. You can share it on social media with your friends. You can blog about it or discuss it on your own podcast. Or you can read the show notes on michaelmoodyfitness.com. Thank you for supporting the show. Listeners like you make it worthwhile.